Blog Talk Radio.
And that was the great Don Covey to bring us into a whole new show here at Deviant Legion Network. This is the Golden Age Revisited with our host, who I'm proud to present as one of the crew now, Patrick Crane. Patrick, why don't you say hello and tell us what the show is about, the Golden Age Revisited.
Hello. Thank you, Carl. Thank you for the intro. And yes, welcome to the premiere episode of Golden Age Revisited. And this is a show where it's basically just a fireside chat where we talk to people who were involved in the Golden Age, or we talk to people who like to talk about the Golden Age of adult cinema. And tonight we have one actual Golden Age legend with us. We have Mr. Howie Gordon, also known as Richard Pacheco. Howie, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
It is a pleasure to be here. I remember when we did our first show together, and, you know, when you called and you wanted to do another show, I wanted to be familiar with the ground we covered, so I asked you to send me a copy of it, and I listened to it, and wow, that was great. I couldn't believe, what am I going to do to top that show? I had you guys laughing on the floor for an hour.
I have no idea.
I don't know where we're going to go tonight, but, you know, you're brave to have me back on. I shot my wad, man.
Absolutely. I do have to say that my co-host on that show, who I was partnered with at the time, Stephen Ronquillo, is not able to join us tonight, but he does send his warmest regards.
Well, hiya, Stephen. I had a good time with you. I hope you're doing well.
Okay. So we'll take it back to Patrick here and just start us off, Pat, with a question, and then we'll just go from there.
Gosh, I mean, I literally devoured both Hindsight and Return to Squirrel Hill in the period of 4 days, I think it was. But I went through both of those, and it's like I've had you sort of in this room with me for the last week because I've been prepping for this. So I have so many questions. But you know, one of the things that I guess we'd start with Hindsight because that's sort of how the bibliography works. But I wanted to talk to you a little bit about your first movie that you were in, Candy Stripers, with the Bob Chin movie. And we talked at length on the previous program, and it's in your book. But if you don't mind going through a little bit of that history, just, you know, slightly, we can talk a little bit more about it, because I'm a huge fan of Candy Stripers, and in particular, I'm also a big fan of Bob Chin as well. So I'm interested to hear about your experiences working with him and on that movie.
Well, it starts with being married, and being married to an incredible woman. And when we first got together, we were like doing the revolution and free love and all that stuff. And we believed that we had a union. And in our union, the members had to say, to raise their hand and say what they wanted. And the union would provide it for the member if they could stand it. Well, I hit a place in my ultra marital affairs that I wanted to have sex with a bad girl. I had never met a bad girl intimately, not in high school, not a professional, just never been with someone with whips and drugs and all the dirty secrets that you don't do with your wife necessarily. And I had all the love I needed, but I wanted some of this recreational sex. And I said to my wife, and the phone rang one day. We were both on some acting roles, and it was a casting call. And she took the call, and the voice said to her, "How would you like to be through an exciting romp in a hospital?" And she said directly, "Is this a porno film?" And the guy went, blah, 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 blah. He didn't know how to respond, and he blew it. He said, "Yes." Normally, in those days, it was very difficult to get female actresses to be in X-rated movies. And they preferred not telling them that over the phone and letting them find it out at the audition. They had better luck casting that way. But this guy blew it, and he said that to my wife. And she said, "Well, I'm not interested, but I think my husband might be." And she handed me the phone. Oh, did I marry the right woman? So I get on the phone, and this guy, he doesn't need a man. They never needed men. Remember coming out of the woodwork. But he stopped giving me the information about where the audition is. And it was my fantasy to go to an audition, meet an X-rated lady, and then have sex with her in the elevator at the hotel where they were having the auditions, and go home. That was my fantasy. I wasn't interested in being in a porn film, particularly. That wasn't on my agenda. So that all came to pass. On the day of the audition, my wife dressed me up and took a picture of me going off to have this experience. And it's kind of cute. And I get to the hotel, and it's very crowded. And I go up to the room, and I'm in the room, and there's a lot of women there and a lot of guys. And I pick the woman I'm interested in, and they read us for the parts. And this was Larry Pierce was the producer of this film. I didn't know him from Adam, but he had directed and produced a number of films by then. And this was the Candy Stripers that he was going to produce. So he read me for the part, and the part had dialogue like, "Oh, baby, I really like to watch you when you bend over and show me your asshole. Oh, baby, I really like when you look at my asshole." Okay. I was a trained actor. These were my lines. So I tried to deliver them with a straight face, and I did the best I could. In any case, the guy says, "Okay, we'll call you back if we're going to use you." And he dismisses me. Oh, no. I didn't want to leave. I wanted to be there to find my girl and hit on her and blah, blah. But I was dismissed. So, oh, shit. Now I'm out in the hallway at the hotel, and I figure, okay, I know what I'll do. I'll just step down a few paces down the hall, and when she comes out, I'll start walking up to the elevator with her, acting like I was just got here, too. And that happened. And I did. I got in the elevator with her. And the problem was that we were already on the second floor. So it didn't look like I was going to successfully mate with her between 2 and 1. But on the way down, I did manage to blurt out, "Do you want to go somewhere and play with me?" And she said, "I knew you were going to ask." And I said, "Well, I'm asking." And she looked me up and down and said, "Okay, okay." I said, "You need a ride?" She said, "No, I have my car." And I said, "Well, I have mine too." She said, "Just follow me and we'll go back to my apartment." So I followed her back to her apartment. And I get in there and we start talking. And she starts talking. She can talk. And talk. And enlightenment comes to Howie. There are no X-rated women. There's just costumes and play acting. And this is just a person with a story, and she's busy telling me her story. And there's no heat between us. There's no passion going on. There's no, "I want to fuck you." None of that's happening. I have my camera with me, and she posed for me a little bit. She showed me a breast or two. It was kind of cute. And as I wrote in my book, around 6 o'clock at night, the alarm clock went off in my wedding ring, and I figured it was time to go home. And I did, an older and wiser man. The problem was, 2 days later, I get a phone call. They want me to be in the movie. Oh, I wasn't planning on that at all. Well, that was okay. Let me think about this. At that point in time, I had had a manual labor job, and I was pretty much wanting to be done with that. I had been breaking up concrete with a sledgehammer for $5 an hour in 90-degree heat, and I had my fill. It was time to move on. and I applied to the Episcopal Theological Seminary, ETS, at Harvard, which was a very well-known place to study history. I liked history. I was a history major. I figured I can get myself a graduate degree. I can flash a Harvard name. It'll do me well. So I applied there. And I had a second choice for a place to study history was the Hebrew Union Seminary in Cincinnati. They also had a very well-known history department. I didn't want to become a rabbi with a congregation, but I figured I could get the degree, study some history, and I'd have a master's. And I applied there. And, of course, the third job was the porn movie. They were going to pay me $200 a day to get a blowjob. Wow. I was making like $200 a week working with a sledgehammer. And then, there was $400 because in those days, most movies where you did one sex scene and then you were in the obligatory orgy at the end of the movie. So you had two scenes. You get 2 days' work. So I made $400, twice my normal salary, what I was making. And while I had 2 weeks to decide. So in that time, ETS wrote me a letter saying, while it's true in the past we've accepted non-Episcopal students as in our history program, this year we need to accept only people interested in the Episcopal ministry. So go fuck yourself, Jew boy.
We're not interested. The Episcopal is working then.
And they ported it a little differently, but that was the essence of it.
Yeah.
And the Hebrew Union Seminary, they accepted me into their program. But the problem there was I would have to spend the next 2 years of my life in Jerusalem, Israel, studying Aramaic. Because when you're going to be a history major, you had to know the original languages you were dealing with. And I had a family problem there. I have an older brother and a lot of sibling rivalry. Well, it turned out he was a doctor who went to Harvard Medical School and ended up in Israel. And Israel was his. I didn't want to go there if he was going to be there, because everywhere he made a right turn, I made a left turn. That's just how it was. So I wasn't going to do that. I didn't want to go. And then the idea of the movie started looking pretty good to me. And I decided, okay, I'll try it. I'm waiting for, in the meantime, I still have about 10 days till the movie starts, and I'm in awesome shape. I had been living at the gym for about 4 years, so I couldn't have looked any better, which is a big part of my story. I should back up here and tell the folks that when I grew up, I had the largest breasts in the seventh grade. I was the fat kid. I was the fat kid from about the fourth grade when it started coming on me until I was 17, a junior in high school. And that was really some sad shit. The fat kid, oh, it's not a fun trip. All you fatties out there know exactly what I'm talking about. You know, you don't ever get a lead in a play. All you can play is catcher in baseball. In football, you're on the line. Forget about basketball altogether. You don't see many fat basketball players, Charles Barkley being an exception when he was younger. So when I was 17, I had tried many times to lose weight and never could. But when I was 17, two things happened. I realized my grades were extremely mediocre up to that point. I kept getting put in advanced classes because I tested well. But my brother was my brother never saw a B in his life. It was all A's in everything. So that's what he was going to be. And the family mythology was he was going to be a nuclear physicist, and I was going to become a gym teacher. Okay. By the time I was a junior in high school, that seemed stupid. And I had to improve myself as a candidate for college, or I was going to get stuck. In the circle I lived in, if you had to stay home, and that was Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, to go to college, you were like a failure. And success meant going away to school. And, you know, you played the academic game. If you were a Harvard, Yale, Princeton, you were your winner. And anything else was below on the way down. So I didn't figure I was going to make that. But I could do better than Pitt, which was a very mediocre school at that point in time. And I knew I needed to improve my grades and my board scores. So I decided midway my junior year, I got my parents to let me stay home from school basically all of January and all of February to study for the college board scores. And the test was in March. I had like low 500s. and that was mediocre, right in the middle of the pack. I wanted to get a 700 in English, and I wanted to get as high as I could in math. And math, I was always struggling with in math. I didn't like it. I didn't want to do it, but I made myself to try. So that's what I did. And in addition to studying every day, I take practice tests of the SATs. And in addition to doing that every day, I'd exercise. I got a very serious conditioning program. I ran every day. I weightlifted every day. I turned up the volume on all that. And the punchline of this whole part of the story is in 2 months' time, well, 3 months, 2.5 months, I lost 50 pounds, 5-0 pounds. I went from being Quasimodo to Robert fucking Redford. Wow.
Wow.
It was extremely cool. Yeah, when I went back to school, people were looking at me go off down the hall going, who the fuck is that guy? It was a miracle. I pulled off a miracle. And oddly enough, a month later, we had elections for the senior class presidency. I won. I got elected senior class president for the next year. So this was the new me.
Wow.
And, the interesting part about being him, when you grow up as the gargoyle, as the fat kid, as the picked on kid, and that's your childhood. That's most of your life. That's 15 years of that. That's who you are. I don't care what you turn into. That's who you are. That's who lives inside that body. So to me, it was all just a new toy to play with. And I played with it. But, you know, I never lost track of what I was. And we're ready for the psychiatrist here to throw in a whole bunch of shit. But I'll just stop that part. So now I'm a pretty boy, and I'm in the movies. I'm going to be in the movies. Okay. Well, the first thing that happened to me, about 5 days before I'm going to go on the shoot, and I'm fucking nervous. I mean, I'm really nervous. My wife was actually training to become a sex therapist in Masters and Johnson's approach to sex therapy. So I referred a lot of my questions about sexuality to her. And she was saying, well, you need to lower your fear factor here because if you're afraid of being on set, it's not going to likely help you have an erection. And there is no Viagra. There is no Levitra, Cialis, shots. There's nothing. There's the trial by ordeal. You're either going to get it up or you're not. That's the game. So every day I was, as the movie approached, I was practicing getting hard-ons. I'd make myself hard, but I didn't come. I wasn't worried about that. If you can't get it up, you're for sure not going to come. I just get it up to see if I could learn to do that on cue, that was my practice. Well, 5 days before we're going to shoot, I wake up one morning, and there are big splotches, red splotches all over my body. What the fuck? I didn't know what this was. I never had anything like this ever. I thought I had poison oak. I called up a science nature guy friend of mine and said, how do you get rid of poison oak fast? He said, you don't. And I described what I had. He said, that doesn't sound like poison oak. You need to go see a doctor. So I went and saw the doctor. And the doctor said, you're nervous. And I said, yeah, but I didn't tell him why. And he said, you have hives. You just need to take a Valium and go to bed. And you should be fine tomorrow, which was really great news because, number one, I could still go ahead and make the movie. But number two, and this is another sidebar from Howie, my favorite writer in the world at that point was Nikos Kazantzakis. I don't know if you know of him.
He wrote, yes.
Okay, good. He wrote Zorba the Greek, but he also wrote about another 100 books, and amazing books. He wrote 1,000 pages of poetry and called it The Odyssey, which was the story of Ulysses. I read that, 1,000 fucking pages of iambic pentameter poetry. And his Ulysses, his Odysseus, was extraordinary, amazing things. Okay, I don't want to get into that here, but the part about Kazantzakis, why it is of pertinence at this point in time, is that he, in his autobiography, he told a story of the first time in his life he went to have an affair. He was married, and he wasn't married to a liberated woman. This was all going to be a secret shit, and he was going to do it. He struggled in his writing. Everything he wrote was a conflict between the spirit and the flesh, the spirit and the flesh. Everything was that conflict. And he himself was involved with that. So he decided to go have this affair. And he was in Vienna, where the paramour, the lover, lived or was going to meet him. And he was there the day before she was to arrive. And he woke up one morning with huge red splotches. No, it wasn't his. That wasn't him. That was me. He woke up. His head had blown up to twice its normal size. I don't know if you've ever seen anybody with this affliction. It's hideous. Oddly enough, I knew a girl who had this at college, and she was beautiful, a beautiful woman. And one day I was walking in the cafeteria, and I hear this person call my name. I turn around, and I see this monster. It's the best word for it. And I try not to, I don't know if she's talking to me or who said it, but she says my name again. And she says, "It's me, Lori." And I said, "Lori, what happened?" And she said she gets this affection once a year. Her head just blows up. And she takes her meds, and it goes away. Well, okay. Kazantzakis had that happen to him. And he, and no doctors at that time knew what the fuck it was in Vienna. And so one doctor said, you know, it might be just all in your head, some kind of reaction you're having. Why don't you talk to Freud? Well, Freud happened to be a friend of Kazantzakis. And guess what? Freud lived in Vienna. So Kazantzakis calls on Freud and says, "Help." And Freud said to him, "I think you got a problem. I think you're having a bunch of guilt. And I think you should go home. I don't think you should have this affair. I think it's a bad idea." So he takes him at his word. He goes home, and it goes away. It all goes away. All of which relates back to me by thinking, having gone through this Hives episode, I wonder if this is going to make me a better writer. I got to write something now to see if I'm any better. So, okay, time to go to work on the candy stripers. You want me to keep going on this story?
Well, it's interesting, yes, because, you know, all the trials and tribulations I'm wanting you to kind of talk about, because there's a punchline to this that I'm interested to get your reaction to. So, yeah, I mean, go ahead and, yeah, tell your other tales about the candy stripers.
I'm on my way to work. It's a 8 o'clock call in the morning. At 7 o'clock, I'm on the freeway. I'm going over the Bay Bridge, and I'm practicing getting erections in the car. I had a jacket in my front seat. I was by myself, and I would, when the truck was going by, I'd pull the jacket over my lap because I had my pants pulled down. I was going to pull on my dick, get hard, not to come, just to get it up and practice. And I missed one particular truck driver. I didn't see him coming up on me. And he sees me jerking off in my car, so he starts honking his horn and pointing at me and laughing. And I'm going, yeah, I don't know. I have to rehearse, so too bad. I slowed down so he kept going. And, okay, I get to the set. The set is, it's just me and the starlet. Her name is Nancy Hoffman. It's a blowjob in a closet. And that's it. They're only going to shoot a half a day, and then everybody's going to go home. So they expect to be done by noon. And, okay. I'm pretty nervous. Nancy Hoffman doesn't really do anything for me. We're not connecting and looking into each other's eyes very much. She was new. She wasn't as new as me, but she was newish, and she was going to suck me, and, you know, I'm back in nappy. Okay, so time for the show. Get on the set. Foreplay is Bob Chin, the director, says, you drop your drawers. Nancy, you get on your knees. And then you suck his cock. When he gets hard, we'll roll. Okay? And action. And that happens. And she sucks my cock, and I get hard. And I'm going, what the fuck was I worried about? My dick knows what to do. This is just, oh, okay. And they shoot about, it's film now, not video. So the magazines that hold the film or maybe have 2 minutes, 3 minutes, 5 minutes in them, and then it runs out. And you have to cut and reload. Okay, that happens. And they cut. And while they cut, Nancy runs off stage to get her makeup fixed up, and they're adjusting lights, and my hard-on goes away. And I'm going, I'm just watching, looking around, okay. And then pretty soon, everybody gets called back together. We start again. I get hard again. She sucks again, and then we cut again. Okay. I can do this for a while, because that happened about 8 times. And by the eighth time, my dick says to me, "Hey, what is this? We're going to fuck or what?" And I told my dick, "I don't know. I just work here." Well, my dick took the car keys and went home. Okay. And action. And this time, Bob Chin, before we start, he says, "Okay, we have all the hardcore footage we need. Now we need a cum shot." So, okay. We go back to shooting, and Nancy starts sucking me like 90 miles an hour. Blah, 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 blah. She's sucking as hard as she fucking can right away. I'm not hard yet. And all the cum in me starts running backwards, going, "No, no, 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 thank you." And I'm just watching the show, wondering how this is going to work out. Well, this was like 11:30 in the morning. We're supposed to be done by noon, and then we're going to eat a fancy roast beef lunch. So for the next 30 minutes, Nancy is sucking my dick, and nothing is happening, except I'm getting more frightened by the minute and ashamed. And any other, I'm in hell. You know, there's a lot of depth to hell. It's hard to describe them all and do them justice. But I was in hell. And then Bob Chin, in his wisdom, goes, okay, nothing's happening. Let's break for lunch. We'll have lunch, and then we'll come back on the set, and we'll finish this and go home. Okay, so they all go off to have lunch. They got tablecloths and roast beef and silverware and plates. It's pretty, you eat pretty good in porn. And I go in the bathroom and lock the door. And in the bathroom, by myself, with the door locked, I'm banging on my dick. And I can't get hard. I can't make it work by myself with nobody watching. There's a sidebar here that if you had told me in the beginning that being in a porn movie was like masturbating in front of a group of people that included men mostly, I wouldn't have been within 100 miles of that set. Masturbation in my life was something I did behind a locked door. I wasn't going to perform masturbating, and I never. Humiliation doesn't begin to describe what that felt like to me. I would have not been near this set if I had a sense of that's what I was going to be doing. Okay. So after lunch, we start back, and I'll speed it up. It's 1 o'clock. It's 2 o'clock. Nothing's happening. It's 2:30. Nothing's happening. It's 3 o'clock. Nothing's happening. The set starts to look like the movie The Flight of the Phoenix. After they crash, people are growing beards. There's people sleeping on the floor. The only guy watching is Bob Chin. And I'm on my ass on the ground, kind of flipping my dick idly. And Nancy Hoffman's got her head on my lap. I think she had gone to sleep. And I start thinking about the first. Oh, and I've gone through. All right, so I'm not going to be a porn star. I'm really bad at this. I'm just going to go home. As soon as they let me get out of here, I'm going to go. I'll do whatever they say until then, but I know that I'm not meant for this. And as I said, I'm just flipping my dick around, and all of a sudden I start thinking about the first girl I ever made out with, Sally, sweet Sally. We were in the ninth grade. And while I'm thinking about that sex with Sally, the playing, it was hand job, blow job stuff. There's no penis vagina going on. I start getting hard. Shh. It might be a mirage. I start getting hard. Bob Chin sees this, and he starts waking people up. Get up. I think we're gonna go again. And indeed, I did have an erection. There it was, a full erection, as full as I get anyway. And he's motioning me to stand up. And as I stand up, Nancy, who was out sleeping, hit her head on the floor. Clunk. And she doesn't know where she is. She goes, what? And Bob Chin comes up to us, and he says, "Okay, look, Nancy, you're awake now. Howie got himself hard. We're going to do that again, and we're going to go back to the cum shot scene." Okay, I get it up again. Thank you, Sally. Thank you so much, Sally. But as soon as Nancy touches me, it goes away. And Nancy's not happy. She really has taken one for the team here. She's worked very, very hard for a long time. And, you know, she doesn't want to be there anymore. And me, Mr. Sensitive, I somehow realize this, and I'm getting my feelings just destroyed. This woman is done with me. If you were on a personal date, you'd go home. You know, you just go, bad idea. But we're not. This is the difference between personal sex and professional sex. In personal sex, you just get out of this as gracefully as you can. In professional sex, somebody else is telling you what to do, and you just follow orders. And that's what I was doing, trying to be the good trooper here. All right, so it gets to the point where it's clear to Bob Chin, who's a smart guy, that Nancy really is not going to be of any help getting me off anymore. And he says to me, you just jerk yourself off now. And Nancy, don't touch him. But as soon as the first squirt comes out, you grab it like you did it. And lo and behold, that's what we did. And I came. And in my mind, when
and
I was
a legend
coming,
was born. A legend was born.
I was hearing the cheering of millions. I was thinking of Rocky, which was brand new back then. Rocky
right.
did not win the fight, the first fight. He just didn't get knocked out. And that's exactly how I felt. I mean, I couldn't call it. It was in some weird way a success, but no, this was not the beginning of a career. This was just saving face and getting to go home, and that's what I did. And I remember I'm hearing the cheering of millions in my mind, and a towel comes flying in from offset somewhere and hits me in the face, and I hear the cameraman and said, "Okay, champ, go home and sleep it off." That was my first.
Well, you know. But they let you come back. I mean, they invited you back to the orgy, and that was, you know, and you got, you know.
That was a real surprise. Because
And it was his first, by the way. That's Bob Chin's first orgy he ever shot. So you were part of history there, too.
Well, he was incredibly kind because I guess he just, you know, like it was – there's a lot of stories like mine – from first-timers in the business, most of whom never come back for a second time.
Sure.
But that's not a new situation. So any experienced director has seen that and makes allowances for it if he has to work with that same person again. In other words, you know you want to have a stunt cock ready if you have that, because otherwise you just lose a lot of precious time. But some of these movies are so cheap they won't hire a stunt cock because it's just an extra, you know, $25-$50 in the budget they don't want to put in.
Right.
But anyway, I got invited back for the orgy, and I actually thought when I agreed to do it, because a lot of people in my situation would have just said, no, I'm done. I'm running. I'm not going to put myself to the potential for this humiliation ever again. But I was oddly struck by it. And plus, I had a sex therapist at home. So I went and told her, and she's just laughing at me half the time. But she was telling me things that I could have used and ideas. She was giving me ideas. I also thought to myself when I was considering whether to do it or not that when you're alone and it's just the two of you, that's a certain kind of pressure. When there's five other naked guys and five other naked women there, that takes a lot of the pressure off.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've wondered myself if that's how you sort of get through that kind of thing, if it's more relaxed because of that.
Yeah. So when we shot the orgy scene, that was an interesting day. I went into to work that day wanting to talk to the men. I wanted to know, hey, fellas, how the fuck do you do this? Because I had just gross-out experience. And there was Paul Thomas was the alpha male on the set. And we had all morning to just sit around on the set while they prepared this massive set. It was going to be five different scenes in one. So they put the camera in the center, like the center of a clock. And each scene would be like 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock. All they had to do is just tilt the camera to go from scene to scene. It was a clever idea. And in the meantime, they were setting a lot of technical work, setting the lighting and everything. And the makeup, we had four men and five women. That's a long time, a lot in the parade and the makeup. And like I said, I was trying to make contact with the guys. So there's Paul Thomas off in the corner. He let me know within 30 seconds that he had starring in Jesus Christ Superstar. and that he was with the William Morris Agency, and that, you know, he was fucking doing this for shits and giggles. He just liked it. Okay, he was beautiful and been in a lot of movies already, X-rated movies. So he was the guy, and he's reading the fucking Wall Street Journal.
And right.
He's checking on his stocks. I have no way. I have no way to even approach him other than shaking hello. And that's all we do. And and then the other guys. One was Don Fernando, who
right.
was pretty new.
Yeah.
And there's a guy named John Rockhard, I think was his stage name. I don't know.
Rocksteady.
Rocksteady. That was
Rocks.
Okay. I don't know.
Rocksteady. I think
he and Don were chasing the women around. It was like the second grade. I just watched it. Because that's the other thing. Not one of the women, there were like four of them there, said hello to me. Not a hello. When you're the new guy in town, you're fucking nobody. And none of the women want to fuck you because it doesn't mean anything. You know, they want to fuck the stars because then they can get it. They might get another job. If the star likes you, he could recommend you and this and that. So they don't fuck the nobodies. You're just sitting there by yourself. And that's what I did, quite alienated and quite lonely. And Don Fernando and Rock were following the women around with their dicks out, trying to, like, rub their dicks on them. And the girls are saying things like, ooh, no pay, no play, ooh, cooties, cooties. Oh, come on. I couldn't do that. I don't care. Couldn't be that. So I didn't do that. I just sat there. Eventually, Bob Chin calls a meeting of the guys. And said, "Okay, all four of you, make a list of who you want to fuck. Pick three, and pick in the order you prefer them." So, I had nobody's name now because I didn't get a hello. I don't fuck women well who don't say hello to me. I'm just not built that way. Okay, so I'm waiting. I'm just waiting. I'll see what Bob's going to do. He's obviously going to assign somebody to me sooner or later. And it's time to go into costume, and I walk into I'm in the makeup room, and I'm getting done. And the makeup lady had to leave for some reason, and I'm by myself in the makeup room and looking in the mirror. I'm like, wow, makeup is really great. I never looked that good ever, and I'm just falling in love with me in the makeup room. On my way out, I walk by the costume room, and in there – I see this tableau going on. There's a fifth woman who has just showed up. She was a redhead. Her name was Phaedra Grant. And she's naked in the costume room. And she's bent over. And somebody's fucking her from behind. Somebody's fucking her in the mouth. And she's given the third person a hand job, which means she has a free hand. And she sees me make eye contact. And she, with her eyes, tells me I got a hand available. And I'm going, amen. You fucking betcha. And I'm jumping in. I'm in. Mm-hmm. And this is exactly what you need in rehearsal because, you know, you're out there in terror. And you got to go see you can do it. And you get some help here instead of being by yourself. So that happens. And pretty soon, one of the guys who was in the pussy, he has to stop because he's going to come. So I take his place in the pussy. And eventually I have to stop because I'm going to come. So when I make my list, I write 1 Phaedra, 2 Phaedra, 3 Phaedra. And it turned out nobody else even listed her because the other four were much more pretty in the conventional sense. The guys were choosing beauty over function, and I wasn't.
Right.
I was, you know, Phaedra said hello to me. So, and then when we set up the shot to shoot the scene, Phaedra and I are in the position number 1. We're going to be the first couple filmed. Bob says, in case you have problems, we'll just go to the next couple and we'll come back to you. So we start shooting the scene, and I don't have any problems at all. It's like I'm a 10-year veteran, and Phaedra is very helpful and warm and gushy and smiley, and we have actually fun. And I do my scene. I come, hallelujah, and then we have to stay on the set. Because we're in everybody else's shot in the background now. And I had Kazantzakis with me. So I'm reading Kazantzakis on the set. Talk about being smug. That was great.
Paul Thomas has his Wall Street Journal. You have The Last Temptation of Christ. You're, you know.
No, I was trying to help. I don't know which one it was, but you know, yeah.
Well,
okay.
You know, what's funny about that is with all of that anxiety and all of that buildup to that moment, what I'm interested in is the Candy Stripers was made by Pacific Coast Pictures and was slotted for 5 days. And it only came to Bob Chin because he said he could do it in three. According to Bob Chin, the original director on that movie was supposed to be Anthony Spinelli. It was supposed to be Sam Weston.
Wow.
So I'm curious how your relationship with him, you feel, might have developed if he would have been your first director and had the same circumstances. Because I know they're completely different presences on the set from what I've been told. So I'm just curious.
I can't even imagine that. By the time I met Spinelli, I was like 2 or 3 years in, and I was ready to meet him. When he'd have caught me brand new, I don't know how that would have gone. I can't imagine it. I don't know. I know that Spinelli was very good friends with Larry Pierce, so it made sense that he would be hired as a director because they were buddies.
Yeah, and he said he just needed, like, he needed 8 days. And that tracks because, as you say, he was a big, big rehearsal person, and he would have requested more time. And so that makes a lot of sense. You know, and you know, where Bob Chin said, yeah, I can get it done in three. But they said, no, go ahead and do five. And so he did the five. But since you did so much, your greatest work, you know, was with Sam Weston. It struck me as, oh, that would probably have been quite a different deal because, you know, obviously – Talk Dirty to Me and Nothing to Hide are just absolutely incredible, and you're incredible in them. And but I, you know, I dig The Dancers. I watched that again yesterday. That movie's amazing. And I dig you in Easy. I think Easy's great. I know you're not as hot on Easy, but I think you're really, really great in it. So,
well, everybody said I had to meet Sam. Like I said 2.5 years in, and I'm getting a reputation as competent with the sex scenes, but I'm getting a much better reputation as an actor if you want somebody to play a part. So people say, you got to meet Sam Weston, you got to meet Sam Weston, and eventually I meet him. And I was working on Tangerine, and I had a half day, so I go see Sam in the afternoon, and he's staying at the Travelodge in downtown San Francisco, and he's rehearsing, he's casting Easy. What he was doing. I didn't realize that. So he tells me to read part of Boy, and I read the part of Boy, and he reads the part of the actress, and we read it once. And then Sam tells me this about the character and this about how the scene fits into the movie, and then we read it again. Okay, this is already way more than anything that's ever happened to me in a rehearsal. First of all, the only rehearsal I've ever been in. All the rehearsing, everything else I did, you did one time through on the set for blocking, and that was it. There was no separate meetings for rehearsal before shooting. That just didn't happen in the movies I was in. So we read it again. And then he had me read it maybe 2 or 3 times more. And each reading, I don't know if I got any better, but I certainly got the Spinelli treatment where I realized this is a for real director. And his notion is, he said this to me then, and I've heard it a jillion times in the years afterwards, I'm the paint. You're the paint. I'm the painter. So he has all the power, and your job is to please him, period, which is really disconcerting in a lot of ways for an actor because all you can do is offer, and you keep trying to mold yourself to make daddy happy. And if you have any sense of how it should be played or you want to play it, well, you don't get to flex those muscles till you become box office. And the director has to listen to you or pretend to listen to you. Anyway, Spinelli never did. He just, if he liked your idea better, he'd say, okay, we'll do it. If he didn't, you had to shut the fuck up and do it his way. And that was more often than not what happened. But anyway, the whole afternoon was spent rehearsing, running lines. And at the end of the day, he offered to take me out to dinner. And Spinelli was a big guy, heavy, fat. And I was living a lifestyle at this point. I was burning so many calories. I would eat one meal a day, and it would just be dinner. And with dinner, I would overload and just be happy. So my dinner, he sent me out to dinner, and I like breakfast a lot, but I don't like it in the morning. I love it for dinner. So I ordered, I think I had 5 fried eggs, 2 orders of bacon, an order of sausage, 2 orders of toast, 2 orders of hash brown, and a large orange juice. And Spinelli watched me eating with a big smile on his face. And that's when he fell in love with me.
Nice. Nice.
That's awesome. Well, yeah, I mean, that was a friendship, obviously, that lasted for many years. And you, like I said, you'll work together a lot. And I really enjoy your pairings with him. Like I said, the dancers, I hadn't seen that in forever, and I watched that again last night just as a prep. And, you know, I really find that movie kind of underrated in a big way. I like it's got a like kind of a Last Picture Show vibe with Georgina Spelvin with the end. And, I you know, very, very good performance by you and by that entire cast. And as I think you said in a previous episode, he was an actor's director for sure.
He was an actor, and then he became a director. So he knew both sides of the camera. And he also was willing to, you know, from early in his career, he would direct the scenes like he did straight stuff. And then when it came to the sex, he'd let the cameraman do that. He didn't give a shit about the sex, unless it somehow was in the quality of the sex was integral to the characters. Sometimes it was. Most times it would just be cut, fuck, back to the story. It didn't matter how they fucked. It was irrelevant. It wasn't fit into the story. But sometimes it mattered. And then like in Nothing to Hide, at one point I'm working with Tigger, and we're having the sex scene, and it's like two backward people having sex. And as soon as we started fucking, well, you know, fucking has its own mind and takes over. And I remember at one point I took some of my tongue, and I licked my finger, and I took the spittle and rubbed her nipple. And he said, "Howie, what are you doing? Lenny would never do that." You know, oh, Lenny, right, we're in a movie. I had to be reminded because, you know, passion took over. So, but he really, that's a scene he watched, and he really stayed on it. So we would keep in character. We'd have a fuck scene that befitting who they were, and we did. I mean, it's a pretty amazing scene. The other thing
that's a very, very touching scene. Actually, that I love that scene, and the thing I love about your character and how much invested I am in your character, especially if you start with Talk Dirty to Me. Early on, one of my favorite second bananas shows up, Holly McCall, and I'm like, oh, Holly McCall's in this, but then nothing happens in the first one. And when she finally has her sex scene at the end of Nothing to Hide, I'm like, I don't care. I want to get back to what's going on with Lenny and Tigger. I want to find out what's going on with their characters. I don't care about that anymore. I'm so invested in y'all's character. So that's the thing I find kind of special about Anthony Spinelli's movies is that they are so character driven, and they, you know, it's like they're very much like just character dramas that just happen to have sex in them.
Yeah, yeah. There's a good.
I want to jump in here for a second.
Sure, welcome to the party.
And just say that's the beauty of the Golden Age, because you were making films, you were making movies that had sex in them. It wasn't like today or you know in the late 80s, 90s, where you know nothing was connected. There was a point to what you were doing. And Spinelli's films particularly are great examples of that. Talk Dirty to Me is one of the greatest porn films I've ever seen. And in the 70s, if I think about my favorite films, like Mary Mary and That Girl from Rio, and they're all story-driven. And I think we've really gotten away from that. And I feel bad about that. So I just wanted to make sure that our listeners knew that when we're talking about the Golden Age, we're talking about films that were done on film, not video, and that there was story was integral to watching. So that's it.
Well,
that's all I wanted to say.
Two things happened in that direction. They found out pretty early on you could spend $150,000 to $200,000 making a porn film, which was an enormous amount of money for a budget, mm-hmm. and not for talk dirty to me to begin with, and then nothing to hide. But your return, because it only could play the same markets as the cheaper films, would be the same as a $50,000 movie or a $25,000 movie.
Right.
So you weren't going to make more money for investing more money. And when they realized that, the whole experiment was over. And that sort of was coordinated coincidentally with the transfer from video or from film to video, mm-hmm. because video really lent itself. Instead of spending $50,000, you could spend $5,000 and come up with a movie. And porn is nothing if not cheap. And that just
you know I don't say this often, but I moved to New York in '81, and by the end of '81, early '82, I was offered to do tech work on video. And I decided not to. I just didn't like the feel of it or that sort of thing. And I love porn. Don't get me wrong. But yeah, it just got sleazier and sleazier, and it's unfortunate. You know, you look back at something like, Paul Thomas Anderson's film, and that they were family, and it was connected. And you miss that very, very much, you know, with the budgetary constraints now and so on and so forth and everything. So, yeah, I agree 100%. It's unfortunate.
And to that point, Howie, I was going to ask you, because you're one of the few West Coast actors or stars who never made his way through a Carlos Tobelina movie. Was that by choice, or was that by it just never happened, or
I don't ever remember auditioning.
I'm just curious.
I never, got a call to audition for a thing. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I don't remember if he paid people well, but I one of the ways I ensured that I made relatively quality movies was I kept my price up as I started to get a reputation. I learned in that business, you don't, it's like, I get these calls from New York, and I didn't know the producers or this or that, and they tell me, they heard all these great things about me, I was, nothing to hide, they just blow me left and right, and then I tell them what my rate was, and I'd hear, well, you're not that good. And, they wouldn't, and they wouldn't go for it. And Harold Lime did that to me. He really wanted to use me in a movie, and the top salary that you could get, I sort of, during my era, John Holmes was his own country. I don't know what deals he made, because he was dealing with the bad guys. So they paid him what they paid him. He got what he got. But among the people who were salaried and had rates, Jamie Gillis and John Leslie and myself, Harry Reams, $1,000 a day turned out to be like the top dog money. Occasionally, there'd be other incentives thrown in, like John Leslie would get new tires for his car, out of petty cash on films. He was always working some end. But that was the top salary. So, and if you tell people your salary is $1,000 a day, and then they offer you $750. Well, okay. But if you don't hold the line at $1,000, you're never going to get $1,000 because these guys don't want to pay you that. They want to dick. It made me nuts when I was doing my own negotiating because I thought of it as like a rate is like a menu in a restaurant. you know, the steak is $20. Well, you don't offer the waitress $15, you know. It's just what it costs.
This is an insurance.
What?
This isn't how insurance works, where, you know, the hospital bills the insurance company and they said, we're going to pay 80% of that. And they're like, okay, that's fine.
Yeah. So I didn't get that. And so I'd get my feelings hurt and I'd say no. And then I wouldn't get the job. And, you know, Paul Thomas went in my peak. He said, how much money did you make last year? And I told him, I don't know, $35,000, $40,000. And I said, how much did you make? He said, I made $85,000. And I said, well, how do you get that much money? He says, because I don't turn down anything. I just work it for the most I can get out of that project, and I do it. Then I do the next one and the next one. And so I had a lot of things I would just turn down. I wouldn't get because they didn't pay my money. And that was fine with me because I didn't, you know, I did a lot of movies with John Leslie where he'd have four sex scenes and I'd have one. And that was fine with me. I really didn't want to work that hard at the sex part. That took a lot out of me. And one sex scene was plenty for me. And John could handle that. I did two movies where I had the lead role and did the four sex scenes. And I turned green at the end of both of them. There was just way too much sex for me in that short a time. So I didn't, you know, I was happy with the way my career worked that way. In fact,
right,
let me tell you,
you
know,
that's
why.
Go ahead, Pat.
Well, I think we're kind of on the same mind. Is that that's something that I'm glad you brought that up, and is that to convey just how hard a work adult film work really actually is. I mean, I think everybody thinks of it to be, oh, it sounds like, you know, it sounds like a piece of cake and all this, but it's so, you know, it just sounds every story I hear from people that were in movies on both male and female side. It's a lot of fucking work. It's a lot. It's hard on your body. It's a lot of work.
Well, it depends who you are. I mean, a lot of people in that business, that is their sex life. You know, so they're not going home to a wife or a situation. That's their situation. They're in it for the. That's what they want to do, and so that's where they get it. But that wasn't my story at all.
Mm-hmm.
So I was going to tell you.
So I wanted to. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Sam was saying to me that day when we had the meeting, the dinner and all that stuff, he was telling me that he wanted to do a movie with John Leslie and me. And I had met John Leslie in Legend of Lady Blue. And a year before that, I was at a drive-in movie with my wife, and we're in the backseat fucking, and we're watching X-rated movies. And John Leslie and Joey Silvera are up there on the screen. Okay, 1 year later, I'm in the business. I'm in my second movie, The Legend of Lady Blue, and onto the set walks John Leslie and Joey Silvera. Wow! Movie stars! I want to know them. I want to be friends with them. I want them to like me. And I go running up to them like a puppy wagging his tail. And John Leslie says to Joey, hey, Joey, look at this one. Hey, and they're going back and forth talking about me like I'm not there. And after a little while, I realized, wow, these guys are really assholes because they're just, you know, making fun of me, chewing me up, spitting me out. Okay, I give them a wide berth. A couple of months, weeks later, whatever, Spinelli tells me he wants me to work with John Leslie. And I said, oh, no, you don't. You don't want me to work with John Leslie. John's good with Joey. Let them work together. I don't want any part of John Leslie. And he says, you couldn't be more wrong. John Leslie, you guys will make magic together. And, all right. And that was talk dirty to me. And, you know, the funny part about that is at the end of that movie, I mean, John and I had to love each other. And we both are actors. So we got there in courtesy of Jack and Lenny. But that's who he thinks I'm Lenny. That's who he thinks I am in real life. So that's how he treats me, like his retarded little brother. Where was I going with that? Oh, so at the end of Talk Dirty to Me, we were by ourselves in a hotel room. And, you know, it had been a pretty magical experience for a lot of reasons. All these stories you know from the book, and, you know, if you want to hear any of them, I'll be glad to turn them on. But this story is that I realized, now the movie is wrapping and we're going our separate ways, that I really loved him. I'd fallen in love with John. And I said, you know, I really love you. And he said,
what?
I said, I really love you. And he said, you want to fuck me? And I said, no, I don't want to fuck you. He said, well, then calm the fuck down.
I love that story. And I love, in hindsight, your final passages about John and Sam. Those are so moving, and then you move in, of course, to your resolution with Sally and all of that, and I found that book to be so poignant, and then your farewell to Richard Pacheco, you know, the little dialogue that you wrote, and I felt like, you know, this would be a hell of a movie if it were made by Bob Fosse, not Bob Fosse. I don't want you to blow your gourd, because I know that was a great experience for you working with Bob Fosse. But Bob Fosse should make, if he were still alive, he should make your story and commission Paul Thomas to do the music.
Well, you know, you touched my heart, because so much of porn is not open to experimenting with the human condition in that way. It get it up, get it off, and get it out. That's what Margot, you know, Bill Margot. The Margot, when Talk Dirty came out, I got a phone call from him out of nowhere. We had never met. And this guy called me up, and he starts screaming at me over the phone. You are taking porn in the exact opposite direction that it needs to go. We are from the gutter. We belong in the gutter. He's guttering me.
That's Margot.
I'm thinking, if this guy was all there was to the business, you know, I won't be. He's right. I don't belong anywhere near it. But, you know, luckily, there were a lot of people that think that's what the business should be. And they're very happy that it's evolved to like a male sexual gymnastics event where, you know, how many ways can you fuck a woman in the ass? And not much more. And that's a big part of what sells. So I recognize that. It's not my audience. But I was lucky that porn was big enough that it could accommodate both he and I. And over time, we reached kind of a detente about that.
Right. Like, he's about, I guess, exactly what I sort of get from him, you know, and but I also hear that he was just a really good guy also. So he seems to be a very dichotomous character.
Yeah, I had that. A lot of people I respected in the business really liked him, and then I would have that conversation and go, why? And then I would hear about offstage what he did, which was real different than the character he played of Bill Margold. I mean, Bill Margold, you know, right. God invented Adam, and Bill Margold invented himself. I mean, it's how he talked about himself. And
right.
A lot of brusque and tough shit. But, you know, he did a lot of really important caretaking for a lot of wild, lost kids. And I respect
right.
that a lot. And he, you know, that's not part of what he promoted or sold
right.
about himself. He was not selling that part, but that was a real part, and that's what I came to connect with. I tried to connect with.
I'd heard that something he would do would sort of be a gatekeeper and almost try to dissuade girls who he did not think were really ready to be in the business, and did all in his power to kind of maybe steer them in the direction away from it. And, explain to them what it meant.
Were a
and,
lot of,
and all
of
that. That. Yeah, right. Yeah, sure. Yeah, that was also another very tough part of the book, and you know,
yeah.
Of course, my condolences about that, obviously.
Yeah.
But you know, it's I'm very interested in how. Just how your life has sort of, you know, progressed. And what I loved about Hindsight was that, because I do want to mention the other one right now, because when I read Hindsight, of course, it's thrilling, and it's everything that, you know, you kind of think it will be. It's your story and as a married man also working in the adult film industry during the Golden Age. And there's the one moment in there where you tell the story about your friend Harold and his death. And
yes.
It's sort of an aside in hindsight. It's not, I mean, you don't really go into him very much. It's just, we were having this party, or no, that's the Uncle Izzy story. It's the thing where, yeah, your in-laws are coming in is when you get that news. That's right, and their car catches on fire. But I love how Return to Squirrel Hill has absolutely almost nothing to do with hindsight. If you just picked that book up, you wouldn't even know anything about any of that. I don't think you can bring it up once, but it fills in that piece of your life so well that it was like, that was such a revelation. I mean, I wasn't even sure by the time I got done with both of them which one I liked better, because I just found them to be just so moving, and I loved how much, how, I don't know, tactile Return to Squirrel Hill was about family and that. You can tell where you come from and your upbringing is what, you know, made you to be sort of the good guy, the white hat that you are, let's just say.
yeah, you know, you're running around in my heart. What do you want me to say?
Well, I want to jump in here for a second. Because Return to Squirrel Hill, which I have not yet read, which I will, trust me. You may not realize this, but you're talking to another Pittsburgher. And I actually went to the University of – yeah, I'm a Yinzer. And I went to the University of Pittsburgh. So if you – earlier when you mentioned that it wasn't such a good school, I gave you a raspberry. I just wanted you to know that. And,
what years
and
were
how
you
about
there?
Them pirates? What?
What
I
years
actually
were you
went 75 to 79. And I actually went to we lived in Bradford, Pennsylvania. So they had the University of Pittsburgh at Bradford. And that's where I went, but I also spent much time down on main campus too. You know, I had friends in the Mexican War streets. When I was a kid, we lived up in the North Hills area and in Jeanette when I was very, very young. My father worked in the steel mills, worked for a copper company called Hussey Metals in Leechdale.
Yeah.
You know, so
my dad's
so,
gas station
you know.
Was on the other side of the Brady Street Bridge across from J&L.
Okay.
I worked there.
I have a basic idea where that is because I know where the bridge is. But,
right under
but
the Duquesne clock. There's a big clock there. That bridge, of course, is gone now. There's a new bridge there.
Yeah.
But and there's a swimming pool there. Right across the street from my dad's gas station. On August, I'd be sitting there, and the tar would be boiling on the ground of the gas station, and there's the kids swimming across the street.
Wow.
And,
you know, but it brings back memories. And the one thing that I know that's in the book, because I was talking to Patrick, is how about them Pirates and how about them Steelers? Because I'm never, ever not going to be a fan, ever.
Yeah, I'm right with you.
You know.
Yeah.
You know. So I didn't realize the last time we had to, that you were a Pittsburgh boy. So that just makes me more in love with you. Seriously, we just got to stick together.
Oh, Roberto Clemente.
Oh, my God. Do you know what? I actually, my folks took me to Forbes Field. I was about 6 or 7 years old. I was in braces, but we were in the right field stands. They were playing the St. Louis Cardinals. The paint is on first. Somebody hits a single out to right field, and it goes through Clemente's legs. Goes
oh, my
right
God.
Field wall,
my God.
And seriously, takes the ball, doesn't even take a step, and throws it. And the son of a bitch was out. The ball, the runner, the beta, and the glove all came in at the same time, and he was out. I saw that throw.
Wow. Forbes Field was my backyard. That's where I was born. I was born on Colt Hart Avenue in Oakland.
Oh, my God.
And in the seventh inning every day, and I was like 4 years old, we'd go over. They were in the 50s. They drew, like, you know, nobody. And that was when I was there. So they opened up the ballpark in the seventh inning every day, the seventh inning stretch. You could walk in for nothing and watch the last two innings. And me and my friends always would do that. In fact, I told one story in the book. I had an uncle who was an usher at Forbes Field, and he had a box seats. His section was the box seats along the third base line, and I was raised Jewish, so my uncle Manny was his name. He was a tough guy. He was a street fighter and a bit of a gangster. But he used to just love being at the ballpark, so he took a job as an usher there, and he'd sit there and watch the games. And we're sitting, it's a hot day, we're out in the sun on third baseline, and we hear from the reserve seats above us, about 20 rows back, somebody yells out, "Dirty Jew!" And my uncle says, "Excuse me." And he goes up there. Well, this gigantic fight breaks out in the stands. And players, it was the Phillies and the Pirates, they come walk over to the third base line, and they're looking up and into the stands watching the fight. They stopped the game. They're just watching the fight in the stands. And my Uncle Manny, he was in it. You know, I remember he came back at the end of the fight. Part of his ear was hanging off. And he said, "I got to go to the hospital." But, you know, he said to my older brother, he was 12, I was, seven. So he said, "Can you get him home okay?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Yeah." So he went to the hospital, and my brother took me home.
Yeah. Yeah, great memories. I you know, I'm living in New York Metro now, but Pittsburgh's always going to be my home. Seriously.
Yeah. 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 Me too.
Okay. Well, I definitely
I have no Pittsburgh memories, unfortunately. I don't have any. They don't give me Pittsburgh memories in Oklahoma City, unfortunately. So I don't have any Pittsburgh memories, except for, you know.
No, but you have Oklahoma City memories. So we just need to find a porn star from Oklahoma City. That's all.
Right. Well, we have a football team now. We have a basketball team. We have the Oklahoma City Thunder. We stole them from the Supersonics. So. Right.
So hi. Why don't you right now give us a little bit of self-promotion and talk about your two books and where we can order them, and let's do all that right now.
Okay. Hindsight is available as a book at www.hindsightbook.com. www.hindsightbook.com. And it's a massive book. It's 685 pages, but it's got big print and 400 pictures. So it's actually only about 300 pages of writing. But that's hindsight. And Return to Squirrel Hill is an entirely different kettle of fish. That is a smaller book, and the address for that is www.returntosquirrelhill.com, www.returntosquirrelhill.com. That's for ordering the printed books. If you want an audio copy of the book, either book, and there's a third thing, are these three items for sale all on one site. The site for those audio books is www.howiegordon.bandcamp.com. And Bandcamp is spelled BANDCAMP, one word. And Howie Gordon is one word. So www.howiegordon.bandcamp.com. And there's the three books there, or the two books, and there's a third thing to buy there. I did a rap song called, what the hell's the name of that? The Legend of Bunny Gardenia. It's a couple of titles to it. I'm blanking on my own fucking project. The Lips of Bunny Gardenia. The Lioness and the Rabbit. The Lioness and the Rabbit. it's a chapter in hindsight. It's all about me having a sex scene with Seika, and I did a rap song about it called The Lioness and the Rabbit, which is the legend of Bunny Gardenia. Seika, of course, was the lioness, and I was the fucking rabbit because I was terrified, absolutely terrified. And Seika turned out to be a good friend, So that's a funny song.
Absolutely.
And she actually wrote I wrote about the scene at length in hindsight, and I talked about the scene from inside my head, and Seika was kind enough to write about the same scene from what was going on in her head, which is a really interesting point of view to look at a sex scene. Because I was out to lunch that day. Well, I'm looking forward
to we'll leave it at that. We'll leave it at that.
All right.
Patrick, do you have one more question for Howie before we get into housekeeping?
Well, just, I'm sorry, I totally did not even bring up the Careful He May Be Watching, which I think is a delightful one and done. I think since it's your only film, it's like your One-Eyed Jacks, or it's like your Night of the Hunter. I mean, you did the one movie, and it's really, really great. Speaking of Seika, you got a good, really good performance out of her. I really, really enjoyed that movie. So I wish we could have talked about that, but I could talk to you for hours. You're a very interesting cat, and you're very, very fun to listen to and to talk to. So thank you very, very much for
do that movie. If you want, that'd be fun.
All right.
Yeah,
we'll see you next
and
month,
I'll tell you what,
and,
I can tell you right now, you are welcome back anytime.
It's your
absolutely.
Show, guys. Call me up and I'll dance.
tell your friends.
I was worried that I just dragged on too long because I get, I'm used to hearing me. I'm hoping it's interesting for somebody to listen to the show, and I just didn't drone too much. But,
Well, no, you know, one of the things about it, Howie, we love, as being a host, that our guests are loquacious. Because, A, it makes it easy for us, but, B, that's why you're on there. You're on the podcast because you bring a whole different, perspective for our listeners. And we love it, so don't worry about it. Not
absolutely.
At all.
My pleasure.
Yeah.
I feel seen, I feel appreciated, and very grateful for both you guys.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much, Hal. You're great.
I can guarantee you we will have a Howie Gordon Part 2 in at least maybe a couple of months. We'll get you back. There's no doubt.
Okay.
At this point, what I will do is what we like to call housekeeping, which tells you what we're going to do. So tomorrow, Miss Vicki Love, if she's feeling better, unfortunately she has a bit of laryngitis, will be back doing her intent show along with me, and we're going to be talking about political correctness and the words and that are being taken out of context, and also the authors and that who are having their books rewritten to be politically correct. You can guess on which side we're on that one. Then on Saturday, Rachel, my co-host, we're going to be doing one of my favorite movies as a commentary watch, and that's Confessions of a Dangerous Mind. On Sunday, Rock This Town Radio with TC, we've got the 211 Rock and Boogie House Party, and he's going to be doing that. That was supposed to be last week, but he was not feeling well, so we're going to do that this week. And then on the 29th, which is Monday, we have filmmaker Austin Allen James, and we're going to do a guest commentary of Steven Soderbergh's Schizopolis. And then on the 31st, which is Wednesday, we're going to be doing Carl's Cavern, and I'm going to do a deep dive into the music of Joe Jackson. And we're not going to do any of the hits. We're going to really look at some of the stuff that he's done that has gone under the radar and really shows his breadth of musicianship. And so we're going to be doing that. and that's what we have set so far. I will also say that we are working on getting together a lot of material for Pride Month, which, of course, is June, and we're working on some things on there. And next week we'll be announcing a lot of the shows for Pride Month. So that's what we have on Deviant Legion coming up. Howie, we're just so thrilled you came today, seriously. And thank you very much for being our first guest on our newest show. And Patrick, why don't you just let people know the name of the show and your thoughts on where you want to go with this.
Well, the name once again is Golden Age Revisited, and I'm just excited about this. I'm got a few people I'd like to talk to and try to get on as guests, and some folks that I chat with from time to time. So hopefully we can get them. But Carl and I will be working diligently starting tomorrow, getting the next one set up. So stay tuned for more announcements there.
Well, I have an announcement. A special gift to your show and your listeners, I can offer them a free audio book of Return to Squirrel Hill. If you want to listen to it for free, go to YouTube or Spotify, either one, and type into the search bar, Howie Gordon, Return to Squirrel Hill. Go to the search bar on YouTube or Spotify, type in Howie Gordon, Return to Squirrel Hill, and they can find and listen to the entire book for free.
Wow.
Man,
well, thank
get
you
in
so
on
much,
that.
Howie.
Yeah. That's awesome.
There you go, kid.
Get in on that.
And thank Jimmy Michaels, my producer, because he fixed all that up. He was brilliant in his audio work in recording both Hindsight and Return to Squirrel Hill. So I owe him a lot, Jimmy Michaels.
Always good to give people nods for what they do. Absolutely.
Amen.
So, Patrick, why don't you take us out? Again, Howie, thank you very, very much for being with us today.
My pleasure, guys. Absolute pleasure.
Thank you. And I guess that wraps it up for us. So thanks for everybody. Thanks for listening to Golden Age Revisited. This has been just a thrill and a lot of fun. And so stay tuned and keep your ears to the ground, and we will be letting you know what's coming up soon. And after that, good night.
Good night, everyone. Good night.
Good night.